Hi, podcast listeners. Jean-Philippe Courtois here. You may not be aware, but we are now in season 6 of the Positive Leadership Podcast. This is actually the 55th episode we have recorded. It's been 2 years since we started. Yes, 2 years. And in that time, I've spoken to leaders from all over the world, from Nigeria, India, Belgium, France, United States, CEOs, coaches, entrepreneurs, authors, changemakers, as well as specialists in positive psychology and neuroscience. They've been incredibly generous in sharing their success, the mistakes, and key pivotal moments that shape their personal and professional paths. For me, it's been the most amazing learning experience. So I wanted to take this moment to reflect back on some of the authentic stories that have helped me navigate my own positive leadership journey. And I also wanted to tell you more about myself. We've never done a really deep dive into my leadership story and philosophy. So that's what we're going to do today in this special episode. We'll be turning the tables. And to do so, I've invited my friend, my leadership coach, Michael Bungestania, MBS, to interview me.
JP, I am so glad to be back in conversation with you. You know, you were so kind enough to invite me to be a guest on your show early on. And congratulations, by the way, on season 6 and 55 episodes. That's amazing. But we go back beyond the podcast as well, which I know we're going to talk yes. about a little bit as well. But thank you. I'm excited to turn the tables on you. I'm rubbing my hands in glee here.
Michael is the author of The Coaching Habit, the best-selling coaching book of this century. And I've been lucky enough to have been personally coached by him in the past.
JP, I'm really interested in talking to you because, as you say, it's 2 years since you started the podcast. It's also 2 years since you stepped away from that really big role, executive vice president of sales and president of sales in Microsoft. And I'm curious to know how your idea of positive leadership has changed and evolved. How you've changed as you've moved to this next phase of how you show up and how you serve the world. So I'm excited to dig into some of this. JP, let me ask you this though. What motivates you to keep going? It's not like you're not doing anything else. You've got your foundation, you've got other responsibilities, you're a great champion for work across the world. And most podcasts get abandoned after about 1 or 2 or 3 episodes. You're on to 55. why keep going? Why don't you just wrap this up and go, look, I did my podcasting.
I'm done.
my work here is done. I'm moving on. I'm standing up so I can make a run for it.
I think a couple of reasons, Michael. I found, number one, that in a way I've created this new routine in my life where I'm digesting, you know, books, but also conversation they had. And trying to absorb completely their universe and who they are, etc. And I love those moments. I love those moments of getting to know someone who was unknown to me, or maybe a big name, but not as a person. Getting to have this, to create that intimacy and expose and surface some amazing moments of truth, of wisdom, and so on, makes me very humble because I'm never sure when I start an episode that I'm going to get there. And then the more I study all those people and the incredible achievement they had in their lives, the books, everything they did, the more I understand how little I know about the world. So that's humility. I mean, the second thing, obviously, I'm nourishing myself by their inspiration. And having such conversations with some really wonderful people who propagated positivity despite the digital experience we have, because we are never, almost never in the same room physically. Take those vibes back to me, to my life. And to me, that's inspiration. And the third thing is about growth. Because again, as I get to have this conversation, those conversations, I'm trying to sharpen a bit my pencil in terms of my own leadership kind of capabilities, what I do, and the way I love to evolve. So it's about growing as well.
What's the relationship in your mind between humility and growth?
I mean, to me, that's a starting point. It's a starting point. I mean, being humble, having humility in terms of knowing that you know so little about everything in the world, and then knowing as well, or I would say being humble enough to not take a failure as as the end of the road, but being able to keep adding maybe some potential skills or attitudes in the way I behave personally as human body. That to me is the relationship between humility and growth.
Let me ask you another question around this. I mean, people talk about humility, and in my experience, it becomes harder the older and the more senior you get. And you're not old. You're delightfully
Thank
young
you.
Man.
You're flattering.
But you've certainly you've had senior positions, and you have status and you have authority. I'm wondering what you've had to unlearn to allow greater access to humility.
I think, Michael, I got to learn a lot more of that through the work I'm doing with my foundation, to be honest, as well. As I started this foundation called Live for Good about 7 years ago now in France, with the mission is to basically unleash the potential of youth from all walks of life through social entrepreneurships, I realize actually how much of a different posture, how much of a different kind of connection I was supposed and was able, hopefully, time after time, to create with those young people.
Yeah.
Coming from very different backgrounds and having a sense of humility to start with, in terms of I'm not here from my senior leadership position talking to you. I'm here to learn from you about your social entrepreneurship journey, your personal mission, and why and how, hopefully, I can help you grow in that journey. I think it has been helping me a lot, honestly, to get there as well.
So you're talking about the diverse backgrounds of the young people who are part of your foundation, but you've also got a diverse background. You know, you were born in Algiers, your father was a doctor, you moved to Nice. I'm curious to know how that experience has shaped you.
Yeah, that has shaped me in a big way, Michael. I was born in Algeria when Algeria was a part of the French territory. Mm-hmm. But the reality, I left Algeria when I was 18 months old. I was a baby. But my family roots were three generations back in Algeria. As you may know or not, Algeria became a French territory back in 1830, so in the 19th century. And for three generations, the Courtois, I've been in Algeria. And so what I learned through this family foundation, which is so core to who I am, is a couple of things. Number one, just seeing and living alongside my dad as long as he was alive, obviously. He was a young doctor. Actually, he first had to fight during the Second World War. He was just 18 years old.
Wow.
And he went to the front, and he was almost killed, actually. So it was like a miracle. He recovered, and he came back to Algeria back in 1945, and then he basically did in 4 years what should have been 6 years of medical study to become a doctor. So he had an incredible hard work ethics, an incredible sense of urgency as well, because he had a single mom, and he wanted to take care of her mom, and he wanted to become this doctor so that she could be proud of him, but also that he could also take care of the people. I've also seen my mom, who has been the incredible, I would say, loving and caring person of the family, taking care of the three of us with my two sisters. And as we flew back to France overnight, what happened, just for people who understand the context at the time, Algeria became independent in July 1962. So just a few weeks before it became evident that the country was going to be independent, like many families, more than a million French people had to fly back to France.
Yeah.
So we did that. We did that, leaving everything behind us, a house and everything else. Mm. And basically my dad, with her aging mom, with a wife, and the three of us kids, we went to settle in Nice, where he basically had to fight literally to be able to open a medical office, because we are not welcome at all in France.
Right.
It was interesting. But as we are called the Pieds Noirs, that's the Blackfeet, this is the naming of this community. And just seeing and living those moments, even I was a baby and then I grew up, and seeing my dad, my mom, fighting for us, taking care of us, and doing that with an incredible resiliency has been, I think, shaping me in a big way since I was very young.
How would you say that experience, both the role model that your father and your mother were for you, but also this experience of coming back and needing to, you know, being an outsider, needing to fight to reclaim a position, to reclaim authority. I'm curious what the how that's been a gift for you, but also how it's been a burden for you.
I mean, in terms of the gift, it's pretty obvious, Michael. I always consider, and it's obviously more than the case today in my life, that family is my core foundation, my family. The people that I part of that family, of course. And to me, that extend as well to a sense of community, belonging to a community of people. And at the time, I could see when the community of Pieds Noirs was back in France, was not welcome, they were helping each other very much, as they had nothing left, actually, to start feeding their families, to take care of themselves. And that really got me to understand the power of community, the power and the sense of belonging. So to me, that's been a gift. And also seeing the moral values of my parents I talked about very much. Has it been a burden? Because you use that word, it's a big word.
Yes.
Well, I could tell you, I was not welcome myself in the school when I was a kid. I remember that. Because when I was 5, 6 years old, at least this is when I could remember my memories. Again, the other kids from my school in Nice were looking at me as a foreigner, basically. Yeah. It was pretty tough. And I remember actually one day where one of those kids, you know, in the school told me, get out of here. And I was both very sad, and I came back home and my dad say, no, you should be very proud of where you come from. And you've got a lot to help them with, to understand the richness of that kind of diversity coming from friends from outside into the core fabrics of the country. So it was a pretty important moment as a kid.
The people who've been on your podcast, you've had so many interesting guests show up. And I know that one of the things that you're always curious about with your guests is also kind of what their roots are and how that shaped them. I'm wondering if there's any guests that come to mind in particular where you're like, this was a great story. You could really see where they, you know, the soil they were planted in, where they began, and how that has turned them into the person that they are today.
Yeah, I love. I always love those stories, Michael, to try to capture, get them as well, understand the roots of the people. I think one coming to my mind, which is a recent podcast I did with Melody Hobson. Melody is the co-CEO of an investment firm called Ariel Investment today. She's been actually for a long time the only chairwoman of an American company, Starbucks, okay? The only African-American woman, I should say, African-American woman, okay? So it's a big deal. And Melody shared with me, you know, the childhood she had. She was actually the latest kid of 6 siblings, educated by a single mom, and a single mom who had literally, of course, to fight for survival, to provide for the kids and the family. And Melody, being the last kid, of course, in the family also, had in a way to grow up much more rapidly, much more mature, much more sensibly. And she also shared with me and listeners how much she internalized the power of the money, the power of taking care financially of your family and yourself.
I had a lot of chaos in my life. We would get evicted, our phone would get disconnected, our lights would be turned off. Sometimes we'd live in an abandoned building. And so as a result of that, I was desperate to understand money. I wanted to understand how it worked. It wasn't about how much I would have. I wanted to live a comfortable, secure life. So financial services, I tell people my calling and my purpose in life was born out of my circumstance.
And so very early on, Melody got this sense of urgency on financial literacy. And in a way, that's been a crucible moment. And this is the reason why, a few years after, and she graduated from Princeton University, she joined that firm and she's been working there for more than 30 years. And she's helping out African-American owners of businesses to drive their business now in the US and globally. In 2020, in the wake of the police killing of George Floyd, I think in response to Jamie Dimon, a CEO of JP Morgan, you came up with a very special plan called the Project Black. Tell us more about where and how you shaped the plan, where this idea came about, the plan, and what are you going to do with that investment?
Yeah, so during the civil unrest that was occurring in our country, the summer of the murder of George Floyd, the vicious murder, Jamie called me. I'm on the board of JP Morgan. And he said, you know, Melody, a lot of people want to help Black business. And he was toying with some ideas of bringing together Black investment firms like mine. And he said, you know, Ariel could be a part of this. And he started naming firms. And I kept saying to him, Jamie, that firm's out of business. They're gone. Nope. Don't exist. And it made the point of where we were as a society. So I said, how do we create a world in which we can bring capital and customers together to scale change in our society around Black and brown businesses and therefore help narrow the wealth gap that exists in this country, in America specifically? Because 95% of minority businesses, that's businesses run by Black or Hispanic leaders, those businesses have less than $5 million in revenues.
Wow.
95%. Wow. So I said, what if we create an opportunity for these black and brown businesses to be scaled, to be tier one suppliers? Because the problem that we have is that if you have 95% of these businesses have less than $5 million in revenues, they're not big enough to do business with the giants. So the idea would be that we would go and buy these businesses that may not be Black or brown when we buy them, businesses with between $100 million and $1 billion in revenue, where we install at the C-suite level at least one Black or brown leader who's CEO, CFO, COO, and when at all possible, where there's opportunity for growth of expansion of those businesses to do so in disadvantaged minority communities. So again, to bring the opportunity to communities, and again, from that perspective, help narrow the wealth gap in this country.
I think you just closed $1.4 billion, right,
Fawn? $1.45.
Sorry, let's be precise, sorry. And very sizable. I love the way you think about not just access to capital, but actually also to people leadership, changing the mindset and the types of leadership we have in companies and customers. At the end of the day, it's about selling, driving also that supply chain at a much higher scale.
That's amazing. You know, you talk about that drive for the importance of money and how that early experience can shape you. And we hear that story about Melody. You know, one of the other core drivers, we either have it or we don't have it, we're hungry for it, is around happiness and around love. I want to hear about whether there's a guest that comes to mind who has an experience of kind of how their story has shaped their experience around thinking about happiness and love. But I want to ask you about that first. Yeah. What's the role of love in your life, and also how you see it perhaps now through the lens of positive leadership?
Well, that's such a big, deep question, Michael. and I must tell you that podcast helped me understand that love goes far beyond the definition I used to have for love. Okay, I used to have, I guess, the definition that most of us have, such as, okay, think about loving my wife, my partner. I'm loving my kids, obviously, you know, my core family. But actually what I found out, and I found that also in my life, you can love foreigners in the street. You can love people you didn't get to know before, like some of the guests on my podcast. And you can have those moments of micro love, if I may call them this way, happening even a matter of a few minutes of something happening to you or because of someone you are interacting with, doing something with, or supporting with, that really creates this moment of love. And this is something I've been enjoying a lot through my foundation in particular, not only, of course, but even in a way I'm provoking a lot more these days, meeting with a lot of people I never got to know before. So kind of broadening my circles of very different type personalities and people. And I would tell you in my podcast, because you also asked me about, I have many examples. Yeah. A great one really was my last one, a French lady called Perla Servan-Schreiber. I'm sorry because it's in French. For many of you, you may not be able to catch the episode. But Perla is 80 years old today, and she's the youngest positive leader I can ever see, I've ever met with. She used to be the head of a very famous magazine in France, actually Positive Psychology by accident, okay?
Ah, there we go.
And she's been someone who had to endure some, you know, pretty tough tragedies, including the loss of her husband during COVID, actually recently a well-known person in France as well. And the way she's talking about her moments of joy, the way she creates joys and happiness in her life, doing cooking, doing some blogs today, yes, blogs, writing books like you, Michael. She's writing books every 6 months. It's like incredible. And sharing your wisdom about the way you can nurture joy in your life at 80 years old and beyond was an amazing moment for me of gratitude in terms of learning from someone who's gone, you know, and do so much actually in her life.
That's fantastic. JP, you shared a little bit about that experience growing up. But one of the things that I think is extraordinary about you and unusual really is just how long a career you've had at Microsoft. You started back in the 80s, right at the beginning of the kind of the PC industry. I don't know how much revenue Microsoft was making back there, but it was like $1.95. And, and it's now, a multi-trillion dollar company. So you've really grown through the organization. As the organization's grown, you've grown and evolved and changed. What were you like when you first joined Microsoft? What were you like as a leader?
Well, John Microsoft back in 1984 was right. May the 2nd. Okay, exactly. I can have that in my mind because May 1st is holidays in French. That's right. The Labor Day, right?
Of course
like
it is,
many
yeah.
countries. And so my first day, I show up in Les Ulis, a very small suburb in an industrial area of Paris. And you have to remember, I was coming from Nice. So I was the guy coming from the south to the big center of the country. So I was right. like, wow, okay. And we were less than 1,000 people globally.
Wow.
So a really small company. And I love that. I thought that in a startup company, I could prove myself more than a very established company who I would enter as a da-da-da and hopefully do something of my professional life. And yeah. actually, at the time, I was super charged. I mean, as a young manager, meaning I was incredibly high intensity, highly demanding on people,
yeah.
but certainly also highly accountable. I've always believed that, hey, I'm the one being accountable, and when I'm being asked to do something,
right.
I'm going to commit like hardcore to do the best of, and really delivering on expectation. So right. in many ways, high bar, asking people to do more what they could do all the time,
yeah.
and driving them super hard in the details of the business, micromanaging the business, right. because of course I thought I was very smart and I could do all of that. So that was the young JP in a way.
Yeah.
39 years later, you could say fast forward now. I realize, of course, that I'm here actually to get others to grow and flourish so that they can really deliver the best impact that our company would love to have in respect of the countries and the world we're operating as a global company.
Yeah.
And that got me to reflect and change a lot of my leadership attitudes or ways of dealing with people and even the way I was spending my time on growing and developing people. As opposed to finding the solution for all those people.
Yeah.
The other thing has been also a lot about, in a way, having a much more direct connection to the impact that each one of the persons can have in their professional and personal lives. So in a way, connecting with the people, the way the work they do is meaningful to them in their own development, but also bring a positive impact in what we can achieve with our company organization. So really connecting the two, the company's kind of mission and organization, you know, undertaking, and the person on development right here, right now.
That's a pretty radical shift. And in fact, you could look at Microsoft overall and its culture and kind of go, actually, it feels like the culture and Microsoft has undergone something of a radical shift like that because, you know, it had a reputation back in the day of being a pretty driven, pretty micromanager, pretty yes. Get results and make them harder. And like, sounds like you, part of your success was you embodied that culture.
Yes.
And then over the last decade or so, there's been a shift of culture, you know, from a know-it-all culture to a learn-it-all culture. That's easy to talk about in theory, but in practice, it's a big thing to unlearn and relearn as a leader, in part because you're learning how to give up control and status.
Yes.
What was that journey like for you?
Well, the journey was both exciting and also uncomfortable. Both. It was really both, actually. Exciting because at the time it was back in 2015 when I was basically in charge of transforming the entire Salesforce of Microsoft to move from being one of the best, honestly, software Salesforce in the world, selling licensing contracts to a bunch of customers, which we love to do
yeah.
as sellers, and transforming all those 35,000 people in becoming trusted advisors to every organization on the planet to become digital companies, digital organizations. Wow, that's a gigantic shift in terms, not just of hard skills, but actually also in terms of soft skills.
Yeah.
And so what I found out at the time, because starting with myself, I had to learn a bunch of new things in terms of technology, in terms of industry skills, business skills. But probably the place where I spent most of my time was to undo the JP of the older days. And when I started that job, first decision I took was to kill a legendary process in a company called media review. And for all Microsoft guys, maybe some of them listening on the podcast, they know what I'm talking about.
They're weeping in a corner somewhere.
It was an incredible process where for 2 months in a row, we are locked into rooms, reviewing literally every single business, every single subsidiary in the world, every company in the world for Microsoft, and drilling down on thousands of numbers and managing the details like crazy and driving with intention a lot of performance management and more. It was incredible. A lot of learning, but a lot of waste in the process in terms of people's ability to do more by themselves. So I killed that process. It was my first decision. But then I said, well, it's not enough. I also need to show up differently. And that was part also of my own development as an apprentice coach, as you know well. And I picked, of course, the best coach in the world, MBS, this MBS I'm talking to.
Oh, gosh. Thank you. You may be overselling me a little bit there, but I'll take it. Thank you, JP.
Michael Mugistania's book, The Coaching Habit, was a huge influence on me at the time. In fact, I became something of an apprentice to Michael because I've been applying actually, the core principle, the coaching habits, not just through Microsoft, doing that across and at scale with 30,000 people, but also doing the same with my foundation. And I'm such a strong believer that the coaching habits are part to me of the positive leadership, basically arsenal of the skills that a positive mindset needs to develop to grow others so that they can have a positive impact in the world. The tipping point for me personally and for the sales force at Microsoft came when I found myself being coached by Michael live on stage in front of 3,000 sales managers at the Microsoft sales event, a moment we captured in episode 11. And you and I were on stage on a very humbling discussion. And what happened at the time, you basically did with me what I was trying to do with all the managers and all of our people across Microsoft is to show a new way of growing others by becoming a lot more curious, by becoming lazy and often. And of course, people want to understand all of that, need to read your books and check your videos. But it was a wonderful moment where I was intimidated, I was worried, I was showing how much I was scrambling on stage. And at the end of that session, I got so many notes from hundreds of people around the world saying, JP, I'm in. I'm in the game. I want to become a coach myself. And I want to transform the way I'm showing up and the way I'm going to help our customers and people across the world. That was such a crucible in my professional and personal life, Michael. Thank you for that.
My pleasure. You know, you embodied a vulnerability, which, you know, is such a powerful act of leadership. Because I still remember the conversation. It kind of went from, how do I get my people to do this stuff?
Yeah.
And it shifted to, these are my words, not your words, but basically, how do I learn to give up some of this control and trust my people?
Yes.
And that statement, that you could feel it ripple across the audience in the hall and then beyond the hall as well. So it still gives me goosebumps thinking about it, JP. And I was, you know, really honored to be part of that with you. So thank you.
In a podcast and with positive leadership, one of the recurring themes is a sense of purpose. After talking to so many articulate leaders and reading so many books on the subject, I know that my purpose is about having a positive impact on people and the planet. And to live this, I focus on growth and learning. Learning from the people that have a vital desire to make a positive impact in the world. And contributing to people through coaching, from the youngest social entrepreneurs in my foundation to the largest enterprise in the world.
Has there been a guest on the podcast that's helped shape and kind of help you stay connected to the sense of purpose?
In a way, I'm in discussion, of course, with my kind of boss and manager or CEO, chairman, Satya Nadella.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of him.
Yeah, I'm sure you heard. When we had an episode with Satya more than a year ago now. And he was making a comment about the job that we have right here, right now in our lives, whatever, whoever we are. And he said, don't wait for the next job to bring the very best of yourself. Right. And I strongly believe in that, which is, in a way, that job that you decide to pick, and I know that for some people, they don't decide necessarily to pick their job, so I have to put that, yeah. that restriction as well. But for all of us who can actually pick a job, wow, this has to be meaningful in our lives because right. this has to contribute to something bigger than ourselves and fulfill not just ourselves, but others. You know, Satya, I remember actually really well your very first speech as a CEO when you said something that really stuck with me. You said, I want us to all the employees, by the way, all the employees who are listening, watching, or some of them in alignment. I want us to find meaning in our work. And you articulated at the time our new mission as a company, succeeding, of course, to our founder's mission. So why do you think it's so important for companies to have a purpose beyond only making profit and money, which is expected from companies in the first place? Why is that so important?
Yeah, I mean, there are two threads, Jean-Philippe, for me in that entire piece. I mean, for the two of us who have grown up essentially through our entire professional career at Microsoft, I felt that there was a reason why I stayed, you stayed. I felt that Microsoft represented in its essence something that caused me to commit. I wanted to invoke that at scale. So in some sense, you know, it was just not by accident that whatever 25 years of my life had gone through and I was still at Microsoft. And so I said, why is that? And it is because of that sense of purpose and mission of the company that I identified with. Yeah. I always, you know, we used to, at least when I joined, which was after you had joined, you know, we used to talk about our mission as a PC in every home and every desk. And yep. the reality is, by even the end of the 90s, at least in the developed world, we had more or less achieved that mission. I felt we kind of were a little lost, and we went on this journey. What is our mission then? And then when, as I reflected on it, the reality is, it dawned on me that that was an audacious goal, right? When it was first uttered, but it was not the mission, the sense of purpose. In fact, I go back all the way to the founding of the company because the idea behind Microsoft and saying, oh, we'll create a basic interpreter for the Altair is about helping others, empowering others to build more technology. And so I wanted to invoke that in whatever reinvention I knew will come, only if we invoke a sense of mission, purpose, and pride, which got someone like me to stay in the company all those years.
When Satya joined Microsoft many years ago, being a CEO was not even a thought in his long-term career plan. Instead, he was focused on excelling in the role he had at the time. One of the key takeaways from that episode was, reframe your job to be the most important thing you could be doing at any given time and get satisfaction out of it. Do your best work now.
So your foundation is called Live for Good. And I know that in many ways you're taking 40 plus years of experience and wisdom and going, can I give this to young social entrepreneurs right from the start to try and accelerate them into wisdom and ambition and courage and impact and changing the world for good? What are you trying to teach them?
What I'm trying to teach them, Michael, is actually the potential of their positive leadership is inside them. My key areas of focus, Live for Good, is really to unleash those hidden powers of positive leadership. And as you know well, I mean, those powers are revolving around three ripples. We call it ripples in positive psychology, so that they can truly understand who they are, they can become self-aware, which is so hard. Yeah. They can actually, with the help of others, understanding their strengths. Then we go and we unleash with them the power of positive communication, because in those roles, you have to convince tons of stakeholders who, you know, and you have no money to invest like a large company would have. It will be the power of your words and the power of your inspiration. And then the third ripple is me, them, and the world, and the way they are building the change by building an impact startup company in the world. So that's what we're trying to achieve. And it's a nurturing journey, which I love to be along, not just during the program itself, which is a 9-month program, but actually year after year, to see them growing, to see them sometimes failing, rebouncing back. It's amazing, because some of them I'll know, I've been actually acknowledged as among the top positive leaders in the countries. Just last year, I got 5 of them out of the top 15, which I found pretty amazing. And I'm so proud of them.
That's
to see the way they are leading, actually.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a podcaster myself, so I'm curious to know, what's the experience been for you in terms of creating and hosting this new podcast?
I mean, first of all, I decided to get into the podcast without knowing exactly what it takes to do podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
It's actually hard work first. Hard work to create that intimacy, that trust as well with someone you don't necessarily know, to give the best kind of wisdom, nuggets of knowledge that she or he has developed along the years.
How do you accelerate intimacy, trust, and vulnerability? Because that's a useful gift to have as a podcast host. It's a useful gift to have as a leader. So what have you learned around more quickly accelerating that kind of connection?
Coming up and starting the session with some positive energy. So people see that I'm into it, to listen up, to really listen deeply as much as I can.
Right.
And with the tone of my voice, hopefully, try to give them a sense of confidence that they are in good hands. They are in positive hands, I would say, in positive hands. Someone is really trying to bring the best about themselves and give the opportunity to have this conversation with me.
I love that.
You know, with free-form discussion as much as we can.
You know, one of my mantras and lessons around leading and facilitating and coaching is to be the strongest signal in the room. Because people respond to the strongest signal in the room, just mirror neurons in people's brains. Yes. So I'm like, how do I embody the experience and the energy I want me and them and the room to have? So if I'm trying to encourage vulnerability and intimacy, I'm like, how do I soften my own heart and open my own eyes and space so that I can invite that in?
I decided to do this podcast as well, Michael, and I found actually a lot of joy doing it, to apply the learning myself, hopefully. So I'm trying as well to capture in flight and after the flight some key nuggets of wisdom, some key foundations of what a positive leader is all about. And of course, it's embodied by very different people, by definition, which I love, the diversity of the people and the profiles. And then really picking a few of that and trying explicitly myself, not to mirror what they did, but to reflect on what they did and, could I do some of that myself in my own life?
I love that. It's an act of nourishment and discipline and learning and growth for you. I see that.
Yes, yes.
JP, this has been such a rich conversation, hearing about your roots, understanding some of your leadership journey through Microsoft, understanding how, embodied by this podcast, but in general, how you've wrestled with this idea of what does positive leadership mean and look like, and how do I role model that? I'm wondering, in this conversation between you and me, what needs to be said that hasn't yet been said?
I think if I'm getting much clearer about my purpose today, if I'm getting much more intentional about where I want to spend my time and the way I want to have that positive impact, it is thanks to my son, Gabriel. Gabriel passed away 8 years ago. And basically, he left me and my family with an incredible legacy. And I've got this quote that I'm still using in a foundation coming from Gabriel. By the way, the name Live for Good comes from Gabriel himself. He created a website to raise some money for humanitarian actions when he was 18 years old. And one day, he sent me this message, "Dad, I have this vital desire to positively change other people's lives." And so that has been the driving force is my son. And the way he's been clarifying for me the things that most matter in my life.
I see that.
And we with my family, it's not me, it's my family. My two daughters and my wife decided a few months after he left us to basically bring the family together towards this new horizon called Live for Good. In a way, redefining some form of family identity on the core values that Gabriel left us with, and with the desire to live some moments of joy together. At the moment,
joy didn't seem available.
No, completely. And so creating that perspective, I mean, it was survival, number one, but it was also incredibly shaping in terms of the way we could, all of us, think about the future in a positive way. If you've been enjoying Positive Leadership, please don't forget to like, comment and share the podcast. It helps other people hear about it as well. And if you like more practical tips and advice on how to build your leadership practice, then head over to my LinkedIn page and sign up for free monthly newsletter, Positive Leadership and You. I'm Jean-Philippe Courtois. I'll be back next week with another inspiring conversation with a purpose-led leader. Until then, thanks so much for listening and goodbye.